From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we travel to central Wisconsin to learn about the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. Then Milwaukee Magazine surveys all the national lists that Milwaukee shows up in and finds some contradictions.
Forbes Magazine gives Milwaukee a spot on its list of 15 emerging downtowns. And then Forbes Magazine also puts Milwaukee on its list of America's most miserable cities. Well, can you be a miserable city if you've got an emerging downtown?
A local music shop prepares to celebrate National Music Day by letting you try any instrument you want. And the 5th annual Okafest celebrates free jazz.
Once you get beyond the flame-throwing tenor players and the screaming drummers and the screaming women and men who sing, sometimes it really can be very rewarding to listen to. It just takes a little bit of work. Once you get beyond the fear of the craziness of it, it really is rewarding.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Good to have your company. Earlier this month, renewable energy was the focus of WUWM's Project Milwaukee Power Switch. We explored how green sources might influence Wisconsin's future energy mix. Today, we'll circle back to the topic with a visit to central Wisconsin, not far from Stevens Point. That's where, in the 1960s and 70s, early adopters experimented and became skilled solar and wind installers. In 1990, by pooling their combined knowledge and passion, the Small Circle staged an energy fair at the Portage County Fairgrounds, thinking it would likely be a one-time event. Instead, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, or MREA, blossomed. And this weekend, it stages its 24th annual fair on its own ground. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz traveled to the farm-filled landscape. She met both MREA founders and its latest generation, whose clean energy passion runs no less deep.
Nick Hyla had every intention of becoming a geologist until he arrived at UW Stevens Point to enter grad school.
Pursued a master's degree in natural resource management, so I started volunteering here at the Energy Fair and was totally inspired. And 10 years later, here I am. Still here.
He joined the MREA staff, first as curriculum manager. Today, he's executive director. Over fair weekend, Hyla says the Back 40, the 40-acre campground site near the headquarters, will brim over with campers. In its inaugural year, the gathering drew a few thousand people. Last year, 16,000 showed up to be inspired. Part of the attraction, Nick Hyla says, is that the MREA practices what it preaches. Every bit of its renewable portfolio both generates power and serves as a teaching tool.
The first bridge to cross with renewable energy is to show that it's doable. And so there are 17 demonstration systems here. They're all functioning. For example, that small array is an off-grid refrigerator.
Even turbines are broken down and put back together for the sake of education.
We partner with an organization in Colorado called Other Power, and we offer a course where they actually build that from scratch on site.
The one that we're closest
yep,
to.
Yep, right there. That's called a homebrew wind turbine. It's connected to this same system here to demonstrate proof of concept. You know, you can do this stuff.
Hyla says key to its power to wow is MREA's capacity to operate as a net zero campus.
With production from solar, electric, and wind on site, plus the conservation from the passive solar design in the building, plus the heating assistance from the solar thermal systems.
That's thrown out of whack when you have the fair?
Well, that covers the fair, actually. I mean, a tremendous amount of electrical use at the fair also.
Yeah.
So if we didn't have the fair, we would be a net producer of power. So it's pretty impressive. I think this site itself has 7 different meters because of the fair and all the ways that it's used.
Hyla's eyes gleam behind his spectacles as we approach the electric vehicle port and charging station. Nothing fancy, he says, but it does the job.
This carport was built custom by us using ADA-compliant commercial handrails. So these are the kind of like outdoor handrails you'd see at, say, Brewer Stadium.
He predicts a lot of discussion around the carport during the energy fair. Given the exponential growth of electric vehicle sales in the United States, he says 120,000 electric vehicles will be sold in this country this year.
So we see this as expanding rapidly, and there are challenges with that. You can imagine the amount of embodied energy in all of that imported petroleum that runs all of our cars. It's a huge energy flow in our country, and imagine that transferring itself onto our electrical grid. I think that represents a real challenge for our aging grid infrastructure and the utilities and how to manage that new load. One of the ways that it will be managed is through solar and pairing electric vehicles with solar production.
Hyla says the renewable marketplace has changed profoundly since MREA sprouted onto the central Wisconsin landscape. That requires that the group constantly reevaluate its outreach and training.
The standardization of this type of training and the integration of it into the Technical College platform has really reduced the quantity of folks that we train per year. We foresaw that cycle, and now what we do is we're funded through the U.S. Department of Energy to train people to train this stuff, train the trainer programs and help other people set up their training programs, and we do a lot of advanced coursework, so stuff that's design and technical sales and code compliance and solar and electric vehicle charging, specific topic courses that are good for professionals and good for advancement in the industry. And we also do what we call the primer courses, which are getting consumers prepared to understand what it is to have an investment and to do this on their business or their home or in partnership with their utility, and also to get people interested in these as career paths. And when I say career paths, I mean from municipal planning to policy to design and installation, technical sales, and all of those kind of stakeholder support networks that really make a market come to life. And so our training is diversified and is way different than it was 5 years ago. It was all design and install training.
Hyla says fluctuating political and policy climates don't displace his conviction that clean energy is the future. He cites that the cost of renewables, especially solar, have become increasingly competitive and says even if an individual government or utility doesn't seize the moment, large companies are.
Now we see the biggest commercial investor in the United States, for example, in solar is Walmart. The modern PV market is really strongly monitored. So in any day, Josh here, who might install a system for someone, can monitor the exact production of those modules by module. So if a module is faulting, you can see on your iPod, you know, you have a module that's faulted.
The Josh Hyla mentioned is Josh Stolzenberg. He leads Northwind Renewable Energy. Walmart is not among his clients, but Stolzenberg cites a nice solar install on the Lawrence University campus in Appleton.
It's going well. We're 6 years in now and got about 630 kilowatts of PV installed. We used to do some wind systems, but the market kind of fell away in that world. We do solar thermal, solar hot air. We do wood gasification boilers now, and we've just taken on home building improvement measures. Kind of run the gamut.
Like Nick Hyla, Stolzenberg entered the MREA circle as a student. His passion appears no less fervent, just on the quieter side when I ask.
Why is this the right thing for you to do?
You mean renewables energy?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Why are you?
I think, you know, originally got very interested and active in it through all of the news and conversation in the early 2000s about resource depletion and peak oil and certainly climate change. And so that drove it, and that drove me into the education piece with the MREA. But then, you know, implementing this appropriate technology in the real world is really what's going to help that situation to the degree that we can.
Clearly, fossil fuels are a limited resource.
This is Bob Ramlo's unflinching take. He's one of the founders of MREA, settled here for good in the 1960s when he left Milwaukee to study natural resources at UW-Stevens Point.
And they're going to run out. Now, whether they run out in 5 years or in 50 years, it's that short a time. And we need to be prepared if we're going to continue any semblance of this kind of a lifestyle.
Ramlo has made his life here as a farmer, an artist, and a solar heating expert. It was in Ramlo's living room that the first energy fair, and the one after that, came to life. He believes the need for education is no less urgent today.
Okay, we've accomplished a lot. But when you drive around, how many solar panels do you see? You don't see a lot of them.
Marguerite Ramlo is the yin of her husband's yang. She sits quietly, stirring her tea, in the zero-net-energy straw bale home they built together, waiting for Bob to take a breath before she adds.
I remember years ago you would say that per capita we have more solar than anywhere else in the United States. You know, little tiny Amherst. That didn't mean it was a lot of solar, but per capita it was. And I just I think this is a community of people that are strong-minded and able to accomplish things, to pull things together and make it actually happen. More action, less dreaming.
Up until a few years ago, Marguerite and Bob Ramlow served on the MREA board and taught workshops.
There's been a change of the guard. We let that happen 5 years ago or six, and Marguerite 3-4 years ago.
But I still teach workshops during the fair.
A quarter century ago, they were part of the spark that ignited energy around renewable. Marguerite Ramlow believes today's crop of MREA leaders is progressive and up to the challenge. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Nick Hyla is the executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Marguerite and Rob Ramlow are two of MREA's founders. Josh Stolzenberg is the owner of Northwind Renewable Energy. They all spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. The Midwest Renewable Energy Fair runs through this weekend. Milwaukee Magazine made a list of all the lists, serious and funny, that Milwaukee currently appears in. Naturally, they checked it twice. Lake Effect returns in a moment with that conversation on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It seems that not a week goes by when we don't learn that Milwaukee has been named to a national list of the best things or the worst things. Some of them have very real policy implications, things like employment numbers or health measures. Some, though, seem like they're designed to make headlines for the 10 or 20 cities on the list, concepts like best nightlife or most outdoor adventures. Milwaukee Magazine surveyed some of the lists to which Milwaukee has been named in recent months, and senior editor Howie Magner joined Mitch Tyke to share where we fall on, maybe, the list of lists. He says the lists are everywhere now.
It really is pretty surprising. I think when we were discussing the story idea, that's part of the reason why we wanted to do something like this, because we're not immune to it. I mean, at the magazine, we'll see some, you know, goofy list story come up on the internet, and we'll link to it and do a quick little piece on our website, MilwaukeeMag.com. But, you know, I think after a few months of doing this, you kind of start to think, wow, this is kind of nuts. And you wonder if there's a list of the cities that are on the most lists. And if so, Milwaukee would have to be near the top of them. So we kind of set about, you know, going through scouring the internet with not quite a fine-tooth comb, but perhaps a brush, and seeing what we could find. And we found quite a bit. I mean, we found more than 30. And so then it was just a matter of kind of collecting them all and finding some that are interesting and some that are kind of weird and some that you would hope that your significant other doesn't know that you're looking at and all that type of stuff. And we wanted to have fun with it, because I think part of the problem with these things is people take them as gospel. Well, look, it's somebody sitting in a magazine office usually and saying, gosh, I need a story, and let's see what we can do to get some page clicks. And, oh, I know, we'll make the best city for dogs, and we'll put this criteria out there. And that's usually how this type of stuff comes together. But the thing is people like it. People click on it. That's why people keep doing it, is because people keep clicking on it. And there's just a lot of fun stuff out there. Not everything is just kind of fluff. I mean, there's some serious lists that are done out there. One of the ones that we found had to deal with allergies, and that certainly has its usefulness. You could also argue the best roads have some value, but for the most part, I mean, drunkest city in America.
Okay. What do you do with that?
Yeah, right? I mean, you know, bar city of America. It's nice that Milwaukee was there, but it's all subjective. So we just thought we'd have a little bit of fun with the subjectivity of it all.
I remember years back, more than I care to imagine, that I lived in Rochester, Minnesota, which while I was living there was named the best place to live in America. It was I forget which magazine. It might have been Forbes magazine. Mm-hmm. But it was a big deal. There were not as many lists in those days. And, you know, this was in the print version of their magazine. And, you know, they put it on signs. A guy wrote a song about it. And for about 5 years, it floated between number one and number three. And, you know, it's like, what are we going to do to keep the number one ranking? And it strikes me you could not do that anymore, because if you're not number one on this list, you're number one on somebody's list for something.
And Rochester, Minnesota is probably still out there floating around and getting tourists based upon this thing back in whenever. But yeah, you're right. It's really become pervasive. There are websites that seem like they're dedicated to nothing but putting out these types of lists. So like I said, we just figured we'd have a little bit of fun with it. And thus you see what became of it in this year's City Guide.
Well, so then let's talk about some of these lists that made your list, if you will, and some of the more serious ones. I mean, they're not all heavy lists, mm-hmm. but you include a number under the overall heading environment. And so what were the kinds of measures you looked at or that other magazines looked at as they compiled where Milwaukee's environment fell?
Well, some of them, you know, certainly had realistic consequences. And one that sticks in my mind is how Outside Magazine went about looking for the best river towns in America. And Milwaukee actually got some plaudits on that count. And that's important when you figure how bad the Kinnickinnick River used to be in Milwaukee. I mean, it was just a polluted mess. And I know quite a bit of effort has gone into cleaning it up. And the fact that Outside Magazine is recognizing Milwaukee for doing that type of thing shows that it's bearing some fruit, and you're starting to see development along it, and people want to be on a river that was once a wasteland, and that certainly is a positive when it comes to Milwaukee. I know this is also a big city for biking. There's a lot of people that center an entire lifestyle around biking, and so when Bicycling Magazine declares that Milwaukee's 24th among the 50 best bike-friendly cities in America, that too shows some progress. So, I mean, I think there are aspects there when you get to these lists. Again, it's not all fun and games. Some of it really does show some progress that the city has made in terms of making itself a more environmentally friendly city. And then you get to a thing like you know, a park score, which is a rating system that's put together by the Trust for Public Land. And they recognize Milwaukee's commitment to its parks, putting it 16th out of the top 40 U.S. cities. Now, that comes with a caveat. One of the knocks against Milwaukee was that it's got all this parkland, and there's quite a bit. And if you've been here any length of time, you know how many parks there are in Milwaukee and how common they are. But it knocked Milwaukee for a lack of investment in those parks. And you know that's been an issue that's been in the news, that we've got this wonderful land and that we're not doing enough to maintain it. And so that's also recognized in this type of endeavor.
They also included us on the list of spring allergy capitals, and it confuses me a little. We are number 68 out of 100. Does that mean we're pretty good as it comes to allergies, or we're pretty bad as it comes to allergies?
As I read the list, it means good, because if you're an allergy capital, you're going to be up near the top of the list. You would think that Milwaukee, with as much industrial things as it has to deal with and air quality issues, that it might be up there. But it's actually not. It's 68th. That means that compared to some of its peers, Milwaukee's doing a pretty good job. So again, that goes toward the issue of Milwaukee maybe making some progress when it comes to this environmental battle. That's not to say that you only judge Milwaukee's progress based upon where it is on these lists, and that's not to say that there aren't other factors that we have to look at fixing. But as far as a snapshot goes, apparently Milwaukee's in not too bad a shape.
You talk about big picture in this article, and there are some contradictions there that you spotlight. Milwaukee was ranked pretty well in a list of emerging downtowns, but the same magazine, Forbes magazine, also ranked us pretty badly somewhere else.
This is what I find fascinating about these types of lists, is that depending on which one you read, Milwaukee's either the best thing in the world or it's the most miserable thing in the world, or certainly in the country. And you don't have to look very far to see that disparity. You can look into the same publication, and they put that dichotomy right there. So you're right. I mean, Forbes magazine gives Milwaukee a spot on its list of 15 emerging downtowns. And then Forbes magazine also puts Milwaukee on its list of America's most miserable cities. Well, can you be a miserable city if you've got an emerging downtown? Does that mean the downtown was really, really bad and so it had a lot of room to emerge? Does it mean that most of America is pretty happy and we just happen to be a miserable place? Does it mean that it snows a lot and so that's why we're miserable, because it's cold? We're only happy three times out of the year when we see the sun? I don't know. But that's what it comes down to with these lists, is you just get this dichotomy. And depending on which direction you look, you can find whatever you want to find.
All right. So Milwaukee has this reputation, if you will, something about alcohol.
I've heard that rumor. We found that rumor on the internet in many places.
Third drunkest city in the country. Is that right?
Yes. And this was one of those studies that actually went to some hard data. And they calculated, I think, the average number of drinks per month and what percentage of Milwaukee's population was a binge drinker or a heavy drinker. And so you can, you know, you look at that type of thing and you think, oh, drunk a city and we'll have fun with that. And Milwaukee certainly has that reputation. But it also points to a more serious issue that this community is dealing with when it comes to alcohol. And it's a fine line to walk, because much of this city was built upon its industry, its beer industry. And so you've got to balance that with some responsibility. So when the Daily Beast put this list together, is that the type of thing that they were looking for? Were they looking to make fun of it? Were they looking to be serious about it? Probably a little bit of both. And that's what we did as well. I don't think it's any secret. Nobody in Milwaukee is ignorant of the fact that it's both a big part of the city's history and certainly an issue that we have to deal with. And so we tried to walk that line as well.
And meanwhile, two other publications kind of spotlighted the positive mm-hmm. aspects of the drinking culture. Bar City of the Year, named by Esquire magazine, and CNN actually named a couple of places among the country's top sports bars.
But that's what you know, I mean, when you're looking at both the darker side and the brighter side, it's a shade of gray. And so, you know, some people have fun with it. Some people will take a little bit more seriously. This was one of those lists that celebrated Milwaukee's culture when it comes to that type of thing.
And we will walk carefully from the idea of shades of gray to this next topic, which is where Milwaukee falls in terms of its romantic reputation.
Yeah, you know, I'm proud to say I met my wife before I arrived in Milwaukee, so I don't have a whole lot of firsthand knowledge. Frankly, I have no firsthand knowledge when it comes to the dating scene in Milwaukee. I have secondhand knowledge, I suppose, from friends who talk about it. But this list came out a little while back where there's a website called Zillow. It's a real estate oriented website, and they did a thing where to move for love in 2013, and they decided that Milwaukee was the best city for women seeking men age 35 and under. And they had this complex mathematical formula which figured all this out, and it had to deal with the ratio of single women to men and how relatively affordable the city's rent was and things like that. So if you're a single woman out there and you're looking for a man 35 and under, I guess you're in pretty good shape. You can't say the same about men who are looking for women 35 and under, or men who are looking for men, or women who are looking for women. But if you're a single woman, you're in pretty good shape, at least according to the fine folks at Zillow.
Well, and apparently if you are a married person, Milwaukee is pretty good as well.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of weird things you can find on the internet. And one of the weirdest that we found had to deal with this website called Ashley Madison, that apparently is a dating website geared specifically toward infidelity. We do not put it out there as a recommendation. We simply are reporting the ridiculous lists that Milwaukee is on, and apparently Milwaukee is eighth among this website's mistress cities, having to do with how many of the women on that website go after Milwaukee's married men. And apparently 28% of women who go after married men are single. This equates to us being this big mistress city. I'll let you be the judge of whether or not that's the case. We don't judge the facts. We simply report them, Mitch Teich.
There's not much more we could say than that. Howie, thanks. Well,
thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner is senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine. He's also Lake Effect's sports contributor. His article on the many national lists that include Milwaukee is in the current issue of the magazine. You'll find a link to it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Scores of people will celebrate National Music Day tomorrow. We'll mark the occasion with the manager of Milwaukee's Melk Music. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. Tomorrow is National Music Day, and at least one local musical institution is getting into the act. Founded in 1956, Milwaukee's Melk Music is well known to at least a couple of generations of area kids and parents, as well as to many area music teachers and schools for their band and orchestra instrument rentals and repairs. To help celebrate National Music Day, representatives from Melk Music will be on hand at Alterra at the Lake Friday from 10 to 3 with a band full of instruments for anyone to try. So if you've always had the desire to, say, play the tuba, this will be your chance. Musicians will also be on hand to perform as well. Nathan Honoré is the assistant manager of Melk Music, and he joins me in the studio now. Nathan, welcome to Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Fred Melk started Melk Music in 1956, is that correct?
His dad and his grandfather started in 56.
Okay.
Fred is third-generation owner, but his dad and his grandpa started that as a purely band instrument repair shop. And his mom, she would run the front desk, you know, but they started it back then, and it's been going strong.
Why band instrument repair? Was there so many bands around that it required that kind of a specialized niche as opposed to a general music shop?
It really is a specialized skill that not a lot of people take the time, especially nowadays, let alone back then, take the time to go to school for, although they never went to school for it. But there's a demand in the area, and there was nobody really to fill it, at least at an affordable price for regular musicians who need to get their instruments tuned up, which with for brass instruments especially and woodwinds, it needs to happen. They do require maintenance just like a car. You know?
I think a lot of people might be surprised at that if they don't either play themselves or had a child who played an instrument. What are the kinds of things that are typical repairs? Let's start with brass instruments. What kinds of things would you see coming into the shop that need fixing?
A lot of it for brass is purely just dirty instruments. You know, you're blowing your saliva and everything into there. So if it's not cleaned regularly with a snake or with a bath, there's going to be a lot of stuff in there. So we have an ultrasonic tank that is a clean way rather than – they used to do it with chem flushes, which from the name it's fairly harmful acids. But the ultrasonic cleans it out in a cleaner way. Dense brass instruments – it's a very soft metal. You know, you could drop a trumpet 2 inches and it's going to do some sort of damage. They're not as strong as people think they are, and they're very sensitive, especially around the valves. Even right now with our rentals, people will put music folders in the case, and that'll push down, and slowly over time it'll push into the valves, which causes them to have, you know, problems and stick and things like that. But that's most of what goes on with the brass is uncleanliness and dents. For the most part.
And I would imagine there's some valve adjustment as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I know on a French horn, there's strings involved because
mm-hmm.
It's a rotary valve.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Those require a little bit more love and care. They're a little bit more modern mechanism. But yeah, over time, a lot of the even trumpet valves and baritones, the casings wear down. So there's, you know, you have to plate them or adjust the casing as necessary.
Do you find that most of the repair, whether it's, you know, brass or woodwinds or whatever the kind of work you're doing, is it mostly schools that you're working in, or are these individuals that bring in instruments that need fixing as well?
I think over time it's been a shift from the private to more school. When they started, it was mostly just private repairs back in 56. But since I think it's the early 90s, they've really been involved with the schools, especially right in the summers. We do tons of summer repairs. You know, we had to rent out storage units because we have no place in the store to keep all of them, which is a great problem to have. But for the most part, right now, it's a lot of rentals that we service for our own customers, along with the school instruments. But there is a fair number of private repairs that we get during the non-busy times of the school years.
You mentioned rentals. Is that something that the store does? You actually rent to individuals or to schools?
Yeah, all the above. We have a rental program. They started that, I think, in the early 90s. So we've been involved with that for a while. And we try to carry over the same principles of our repairs, you know, affordability and quality product to give to people and to share the gift of music, because it can be expensive.
It can be, absolutely. What about you? Now, you're working right under Fred.
Mm-hmm.
Your title is officially assistant manager, but you basically are managing
right. The
whole operation. How did you get involved, and do you have a repair background? Did you go to school for that?
No, I went to school originally for tuba performance, which it didn't take long for me to realize that was pretty out there. That's not what I wanted to do with my life. But I actually took lessons at Melk Music since I was about 10 years old till when I graduated from high school. And my family has had a connection with the Melks for a long time. So I went to school, kind of did my thing there, and then moved away from music a little bit, and then came back once my wife and I moved back into the area. And Fred was good enough to offer me a job. But I play mostly low brass, but since about high school, I've been gigging with guitar and bass as well, which is something we don't do a whole lot with right now, but we're slowly getting into that side of things.
Okay, so it's not going to be just like wind and band instruments. You're going to start doing more rock and roll stuff?
Yeah, we're going to start off with some acoustic guitars this summer and see how it goes. We started with some ukuleles this January after I got back from a conference, and it was like, yeah. We're about 4 years late to that trend, but you know, it's still a very popular thing, and it's a very affordable way to get people involved with music, because we do band and orchestra already, so it's a natural progression of things, I think.
How long have you been working for the Melks now?
Just under 2 years.
Okay, so you haven't seen a long-term trend, but you know, certainly Fred has. Have the cutbacks in music in schools affected your business either way, positively or negatively?
It hasn't been a huge shift, which is good. There are some school districts that are hurting more than others. We've adjusted accordingly. Like, we have a price list for repairs that, you know, emergencies or those with a definite budget, and hopefully we can help them over the long run to maximize their budgets as best as possible. But we haven't seen anything dramatic in the store. That was actually one of my first questions when I got interviewed with Fred was, you know, how is things going in the store right now? Is this taking a toll? But it really hasn't hurt us too bad. I think the worst of it's over, and the more that people realize that music is a vital part of education, which there is more and more advocacy for that these days, the programs will remain strong. And we're getting a lot of teachers in right now who are maybe fresh out of school, who have great enthusiasm. Not to say that the ones who are retiring are poor by any means, but there's a new energy in a lot of these schools that we're trying to partner up with and make sure that those programs are as strong as possible.
Do you find, or has Fred found, that Melk Music has had to step in some circumstances when schools have had to make cuts that they may not want to have made, but they had to because of budgets? Has Melk stepped in to kind of provide instruments to students?
Yeah, we've had to do that a couple times, sometimes more so with MPS than anything else. But it's not as bad. You know, a lot of schools have a fairly decent inventory, especially of the more expensive instruments like French horn, baritone, the ones that are more uncomfortable to carry to and from school as well, but they're a lot more expensive to rent. And a lot of schools will have those, and then we're finding ways to work with them to make sure that their inventory is at the best, even if they're not renting from us, that they're working as best as possible, because the kids got to play on something.
Right. You know? And they have to be able to make a good sound.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they won't continue with it.
Exactly. That frustration is a lot of what deters people from continuing past eighth grade, simply not having an instrument that works. We try to eliminate that as much as possible. It should not be the thing that turns somebody off from music.
So tell me about the what is the official title of Friday?
National Music Day. It's something that's been going on in the nation for a couple of years, although Milwaukee is never really formally involved. Madison this year has something for the first time where they have a citywide music where you can literally play almost anywhere. They waived all of like the noise ordinances and things like that, which is a great role model. And it's, I think it's about time that Milwaukee stepped in, because Chicago has it, New York has it, Kalamazoo. they've all got a National Music Day going on. So this year we're starting kind of small, but it's some place to start. And Altera has been nice enough to partner with us to make it happen.
What can people expect if they come down to Altera and see you there?
We're just going to have some tables out with a bunch of our instruments, and whether people have played daily or haven't played in 40 years, never played an instrument, we encourage you to come down and play. It's an affirmation of music as a vital part of our community. So we'll have our instruments there, have some, even some ukuleles, hopefully some hand drums as well, and then some local musicians hopefully playing throughout the day from 10 to 3, hopefully weather provided that everything goes well.
So people can come, they can try out instruments, maybe one they've always wanted to try.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we'll provide reeds, you know, obviously we'll sanitize everything in between. Some of our staff has background in music education, so they can really help people play an instrument they've never played before, buzz their lips and all that kind of stuff. And people can bring their own instruments too, just play.
And I'm assuming kids are welcome as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Anyone's encouraged to come down and try and play. And, you know, music is supposed to be fun. You know, that's why they call it playing.
Well, Nathan, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. And best of luck with National Music Day at Altera. Let's hope for good weather.
Yeah, let's hope. Fingers crossed. Thank you very much.
Nathan Honoré is the assistant manager at Milwaukee's Melk Music. They will be at Altera at the Lake tomorrow from 10 until 3 with instruments to try. Members of Milwaukee's own Present Music will be there as well. In the interest of full disclosure, I'll be there for part of the time as well, and I'm looking forward to it. There's more information about the event at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, it's not directly linked to National Music Day, but our last segment is about a local music festival that begins tomorrow as well. We'll learn more about OkaFest when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Stay tuned. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Free jazz. If hearing those two words together makes you close your eyes and shudder, Bruno Johnson wants to have a word. Johnson is the founder and owner of Milwaukee's Okadisc Records, which is dedicated to recording musicians who perform improvised jazz. Johnson is also the owner of Sugar Maple and the Palm Tavern, and this weekend Sugar Maple is home to not only its 60 varieties of American craft beer, but also to the 5th annual OkaFest, celebrating 20 years of the Okadisc label. OkaFest is co-curated by Johnson along with painter Adrian Pierluisi and musician Ken Vandermark, and this year it will feature bands from as far away as Ethiopia. Johnson joins me in the studio now. Bruno, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, nice to be here.
Tell me about Okadisc. Why did you start this particular label? Why jazz? Because I know you originally had some rock and roll background.
I originally was in a had a rock label for quite a while, and I was listening to more and more experimental rock, and I realized that, and a friend of mine helped me along the way, but there were jazz musicians who kind of played in the same territory, Art Ensemble of Chicago being a big one, and I went and saw them live. I must have been 22 or 23, and I loved them because they could play this crazy cacophonous noise and yet actually know how to play an instrument. They didn't have to just bang on metal or beat on a bass. So I started looking into jazz records and buying them. Been an obsessive record collector my whole life, so it fit right in. And about 10 years later, I decided I want to actually do something for people who make this great music, because it is a very niche market. So I started the label.
And how successful has it been?
It's successful because it's really rewarding, but the market for it is very small. And, I mean, I've got a very good hold of the people who are invested as purchasers, so I do fairly well. But it's not, I mean, I have a real job.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, you're not making a lot of money
no.
on this. Yeah.
And as like we were talking earlier, as things transform from physical digital product to digital through the computer, less and less people are actually purchasing. I think it's more and more downloading or borrowing from friends. And I have problems with that whole concept, but that's the way the business is going, so that's the way it's going. I guess I'll have to follow it if that's what I do. But I really do like the physical product. I like looking at the cover. I like reading the liner notes. And
yeah, I have to agree with you. Maybe it's just it's my age is telling. But, I love having the thing to hang on to. I mean, I download all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I purchase it, but mm-hmm. I download all the time if that's quick. But if it's an artist that I'm really interested in, I want all of that extra stuff.
Right.
So do you find that the people who are interested in this kind of niche jazz, because it really isn't mainstream jazz, it's pretty much on the one end of the bell curve or the
Definitely,
other,
yes.
They're wanting the same kind of detail? They're wanting that kind of physical object?
I think so. It's a little older demographic, so you get people who are a little bit – they're set in what they do, and they do collect. And if they do collect a particular artist, they want everything, and they want to have that artifact, that piece.
Well, what about vinyl? Because that's been making a comeback, right. too. All of a sudden, everybody seems to want vinyl again, and we all thought that we were putting our records away 30 years ago right. and never going to play them again, and all of a sudden now everybody wants to.
Right, and we're back to doing vinyl again, too, and that sells just as well as CDs do.
It's, really?
Yeah. They're so much more expensive to make. It's a little ridiculous and to ship.
But people are buying.
People are buying, yeah.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's a sound thing? I mean, you've been running a label now for almost 20 years. Mm. Are people liking the sound difference?
I think there's a bit of sound difference. A lot of it is a format that everybody who listens to music grew up buying. So I think it fits the love they have for the object again.
Maybe that more than the music?
A bit of both, I think.
Okay.
The nostalgia of the album and the music. And that new things are coming out on vinyl, that you're not just hunting down those rarities from the 70s, say.
What about a younger audience? I mean, as you say, this is a niche market, this kind of jazz. But are there younger people coming to it and discovering it like you did when you were 22 or 3?
Yeah, I think there is. There's always a handful of people who somebody turns them on to it. It becomes their music. Like any kind of marginal art, you know, there are going to be people who seek it out. And it's very rewarding music to listen to once you get into it and realize that it's more than just noise and sound. And
well, I was going to say, talk about that a little more, because a lot of people would say, well, it's just noise.
Right. And I think if you come from a traditional jazz background of big bands and bop bands, improvised music or free jazz can really sound cacophonous and wild, because quite often it is. Quite often it's beautiful and elegant and quiet and serene. It's been around for quite a long time. I mean, Jimmy Giuffre was improvising in the late 50s, and those records are gorgeous, and people collect those not even really knowing that it's more improvised than it is traditional jazz. And I think once you get beyond the flame-throwing tenor players and the screaming drummers and the screaming women and men who sing sometimes, it really can be very rewarding music to listen to. It just takes a little bit of work. It's like avant-garde film or dissonant books. Once you get beyond the fear of the craziness of it, it really is rewarding.
Well, who would you suggest somebody new to this would to start with so that they can find their way into this and maybe find something that they would love?
To start, I think the easiest way is to really go back to the beginnings of Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane and Cecil Taylor and Archie Shepp, because there are a lot of those records from the late 50s and early 60s are very much in the canon of regular jazz now, but they definitely do lead you into bands like the Art Ensemble of Chicago or Cecil Taylor that had a sort of a song form at the beginning, but then went into like open improvisation or lost the song just for the feel of the music. And then there are artists like Ken Vandermark, who records a great deal for me, who does still use the song format quite a bit. He is a copious writer. You're riding with him in a car. It's insane because he's got paper and he's writing music all the time or chatting online, talking to people about music. And think of it, it's sort of like contemporary classical music, really. I mean, it has the elements of what people want from music. It just has this extra modern aspect, I guess.
Maybe take on it or
yeah.
something.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the difference between improvising within a song, which a lot of jazz does, even mm-hmm. the more traditional jazz, right. you know, they'll take off and do a solo and people will trade off, and this kind of free improvisation, where's the line?
Well, it's quite often it really is the same sort of thing. I mean, there are bands that kind of have a structured tune and then they improvise off of that.
Is that something that you prefer? I mean, or do you prefer the stuff that where they're just kind of going?
I prefer it all. I mean, I listen to old 78s of Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Fletcher Henderson, because improvising has been around forever. And it's the wonderful part of the jazz and this musical style. It just now, in the last 40 years, became the the focal point of the music as opposed to the playing the tune and having your chorus or two choruses.
Right, your chance
or 10 choruses, depending on who the soloist was.
Exactly, how indulgent you were going to be that day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned your day job earlier, and of course that's running Sugar Maple.
Right, I have two bars, Sugar Maple and Palm Tavern.
Yeah. Right, and of course they are vehicles also for music.
They are, yes.
Yes. Are they specifically vehicles for music, or did you set them up because of this other love that you have?
Well, the music's very important to me. We don't play a lot of jazz because it's not really background music, but we do have events. We're fortunate that the Sugar Maple, when we picked up the building, that there's a room in the back that holds about 40, 50 people, which is just perfect for this kind of music because that's really about the maximum crowd you're going to get. It's isolated from the rest of the bar, so you can have a performance back there, and it's almost sonically perfect for it. So they just kind of melded together. Profit off beer. Lose money playing music.
There you go. Yeah. That's pretty much it. Ockerfest is about to happen.
Correct.
And this is the fifth year?
Fifth year. Mm-hmm.
You've done it. And is that happening in that back room, or is it happening in both bars?
It happens Friday and Saturday night in the back room. There's three sets each night. One set on the afternoon of Saturday at the Palm, and then Sunday afternoon we play in the front room at the Sugar Maple.
Okay.
We close to the public until 7 or 8, and we have an early evening performance.
So talk about the fest. Did this just come out of the label and you wanting to get these guys in front of a live audience?
Well, a lot of the people who record for me perform at the Sugar Maple, and it just happened 5 years ago that one of my artists was coming through town, and my wife and I decided we should set up a small, we didn't even call it a festival, but like a weekend event around this particular artist. And so we contacted Ken Vandermark in Chicago, and he helped us find some people. And we had such a good time that within a week of the first festival, we were already talking about the second one, and now we're down to the fifth one. So, and we're expanding out a little bit. It used to be pretty much anybody that was Rokudisc related, and now the last couple of years we've had artists who are in the same sort of genre but haven't necessarily recorded for me. And this year we now have an Ethiopian group, which has really taken it one step farther.
Yeah, talk about them, because that was what really got me interested in finding out more about you and then realizing you were just right down the street, and we needed to talk about that. But how did you get in touch with these guys? How do you know them?
Again, Ken Vandermark, who performs in Europe quite a bit, and he records with and tours with a group called The X from Holland, which is an old punk band, but they have over the years incorporated more and more jazz musicians into what they do. And every year they go to Ethiopia for 2 weeks and perform with local Ethiopian bands. They bring a man from Holland who repairs brass instruments, and he spends the entire time repairing instruments there for free. And over the years they've slowly built up a network where they bring Ethiopian groups to Europe and now to America. This will be the second or third group they brought here. It just happened to jive with the festival that we could bring Fendika up to Milwaukee. They were going to originally start in Chicago, their tour, but they're starting a day early with us. So.
How nice.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
So what kind of music is this? Is this more of that free jazz, or are they doing something else?
It's more traditional Ethiopian music, but there's kind of an improvising element in it where there's definitely a strong song structure. This group has three musicians, I believe, if I remember correctly, two dancers and two singers. So there's dance moves that are very choreographed, but also open space along with the vocalizing. There's tunes, but they kind of like old blues records. You kind of
go anywhere.
If you got something else you want to say, then you say it. And then the musicians get to be open too. They're going to play on Sunday afternoon, the full group. I'm trying to think. Saturday evening, I think there's a couple of the musicians are going to play with some jazz musicians. So it'll be a little bit of
a mix.
Yeah.
And again, for the people who might not know much about this music and are dipping their toe into this for the first time, who would you recommend that they come see if they pick one group?
I would say come Sunday. It's going to be the one that's going to be the easiest to get into because we're going to do it in the front room and we can hold about 100 people there. And you'll see Ken Vandermark and Paul Nielsen Love, a Norwegian drummer, play with Terry X, who's the guitar player from The X. It'll be raucous but fun to watch, I think. They play really well together. The three of them play in a group together with another guitarist. And then you'll get Fendika, which will be more traditional African music. So you'll get a little bit of both. You'll get the heavy end of improvised music and this beautiful music that rarely comes here.
Next year will be your 20th anniversary,
yeah,
won't
mm-hmm.
it? Yeah, for Ockerdisc. What do you think? What's the future looking like for a record label?
I don't know. I guess we'll see. It's one of those interesting things. Every year I think, oh, this is going to be the end because nobody's buying anymore, and then records come back. So who knows? Who knows? I would love to keep going. I was never a musician myself, and so to help musicians is a real good joy in my life, and I would like to be able to keep doing that. And if this helps, then I'll keep doing it. It's so much fun to do. The people who are involved in this music are the most approachable, interesting people because they don't have pretension. Well, some do. But for the most part, they're all very beautiful people. You can meet some of the most famous improvising musicians on the street and just talk to them, and they're just the most normal folk. And it's fun. So I hope it keeps going.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit about your label. And thanks for telling us about the festival this weekend. It sounds like it's going to be a blast.
Oh, I hope so. It should be a lot of fun.
Thank you, Bruno.
You bet.
Bruno Johnson is the owner of Sugar Maple and the Palm Tavern and the founder and owner of Oka Disc Records. Oka Fest begins tomorrow at the Sugar Maple and it runs through the weekend. There's more information and a schedule at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.